From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners. We're very thankful for all of you. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Our busy interfaith calendar includes the interfaith commemoration of Four Chaplains Sunday, and Orthodox Christians observe Triodion on February 1st. Monday is the Christian feast of Candlemas and the Wiccan pagan Imbolc and Lunasa. Followers of Shinto mark Subuni Sai on the 3rd, and Wednesday brings the Jewish celebration of Tu B'Shvat. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
The images of Auschwitz from above are haunting, showing just how sprawling the camps were. So many prisoners freed by Soviet troops 70 years ago today, but not before more than a million lost their lives. One survivor saying the greatest debt we have today is to pass on the memory of their lives to others, their will to live.
You know, it's been 70 years since the liberation of Auschwitz. What is crucial about remembering the Holocaust? And what must we do to renew its lessons for future generations? An important conversation I'll have is with Shana Penn, Executive Director of the Tobey Foundation for Jewish Life and Culture.
We cannot survive as a republic if we do not become, once again, a God-centered nation that understands that our laws do not come from man, they come from God.
I've dropped twice an email to 100,000 evangelical pastors in America saying, has he called you to run for city council and county commissioner, school boards, state representative, mayor, Congress in 16?
We have more freshmen, members of the House of Representatives, who understand biblical truth than we have had for decades.
The seven spheres of influence, often referred to as seven mountains, represent the big areas of culture. Those areas were the area of religion, the mountain or the influence of family, the sphere of influence around civil government, the sphere of influence or mountain around business and economics, the influence that was granted in the area of media. How many of you know these belong to God?
We can't just elect a candidate and fix what ails our country. We can't just pass a law and fix what ails our country. We need a spiritual revival to fix what ails our country.
For anyone eager to see religion made subservient to politics in this country, last weekend was akin to the World Series, the Super Bowl, the NBA playoffs, and the Stanley Cup all together. From Louisiana to Iowa, from Oklahoma to Texas, and back to Louisiana again, not forgetting Washington, D.C., the voices of ambitious politicians ready to pander to the most exclusionary and undemocratic instincts imaginable were raised. Not in unison, but more akin to the biblical story of Babel. If you think it's too early to be thinking about 2016 campaign politics, I assure you, you are mistaken. The race for credibility and private money is well underway. And if you think I'm overstating the case regarding the desperate quest for being seen as having God's endorsement, well, by the end of this hour, you might change your mind. And if you think this is a struggle that's happening safely on the far-off fringes of our secular constitutional democracy, please understand that whoever can convincingly tell billionaire funders, look, I bring this many million fundamentalist Christian voters with me, is going to be at a huge advantage to get access to the kind of money that was unimaginable prior to the Citizens United Supreme Court ruling. So, what are the events we're talking about? Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal's no-holds-barred Christianist rally drew thousands, and many more watched the live webcast on a website audaciously named God.TV. People for the American Way senior fellow Peter Montgomery was in Baton Rouge for the event titled The Response. Meanwhile, The Iowa Freedom Summit brought together a who's who of past and possibly future presidential candidates to explain why God wants Obamacare repealed and Islam, immigration, and marriage equally opposed. Oh, yeah, and he wants Roe versus Wade reversed as well. Evidence of that included the annual March for Life in our nation's capital. We'll get insights on what all of this portends from investigative journalist Sarah Posner. Well, make no mistake, we're not endorsing or even commenting on the political agenda of any party or candidate here. What I am deeply concerned about is the relentless attempt to turn our political system into a theocratic referendum. It's not a threat any of us can afford to dismiss. So with that longer than usual introduction, I'm very happy to turn again to Peter Montgomery, Senior Fellow at People for the American Way. So you made the trip to Louisiana to experience the response firsthand. Start, please, by talking briefly about what that event was.
Yeah, it was billed as a prayer rally for Christians to come and pray for the future of the nation. And, you know, Bobby Jindal and the organizers were trying to tell the press, oh, this is not a political event. This is just a spiritual event, Christians coming together to pray. But that's ludicrous when you look at who organized it and how it was promoted. Well, the invitation came out from Bobby Jindal on his official letterhead as governor of Louisiana, saying that politicians and policy change could not save America. America needed Jesus. And he also, on his letterhead, sent an invitation to the other 49 governors of the United States, inviting them to come and also to lift up the name of Jesus and to ask for divine intervention. So there's a whole Christianist thing to talk about right there. Yeah. The organizer of this event is a guy named David Lane, whose goal in life is to return America to the Pilgrims' idea of a nation that was meant to advance the Christian faith. And he believes that the country was founded by and for Christians, and he wants to return us to that. He's recruiting 1,000 conservative evangelical pastors to run for office in 2016. And Bobby Jindal spoke the day before his non-political prayer rally. He spoke at a recruiting event for that project.
Yeah. Peter, why didn't he go into the ministry or go into full-time evangelism?
I tell you, if you saw Bobby Jindal and you listened to him, I wondered the same thing. He clearly has the makings of someone who could be a preacher if he wanted to be.
Yeah.
And he
don't throw him in with all the preachers. I'm one of them. I don't want that association.
Well, you know, it was striking to hear him talking because, again, if he was someone who was a lay leader in his church and gave that sermon in his church, nobody would have any problem with that. But he was using the power of his public office to promote this very exclusionary rally, which basically, you know, said to non-Christian Americans and to the non-Christian governors, I don't really see a place for you in solving America's problems. And that is a really divisive and toxic message.
Yeah. It honestly makes you think that if he really believes that, he ought to get out of government and get into religious activities because he's given up on our democracy. Peter, you wrote about this for the Huffington Post. What stood out for you at the response that you wrote about?
One is that both the MC of the event, Doug Stringer, and Gene Mills, the head of the Louisiana Family Forum, which is an affiliate of the Family Research Council, talked about Seven Mountains theology, which is really this dominionist theology that every sphere of society, including government, needs to be run by the right kind of Christians. Mm-hmm. And they talked about the fact that right now those mountains are occupied by the enemy, and so they need to be evangelized and occupied. And oftentimes when people like me talk about dominionism, you know, the mainstream media dismisses that as it's some kind of a really fringe thing, and you're making something, your mountain out of a molehill, so to speak. And yet here we were on the same stage with the governor who may be running for president, talking about this kind of theology. Again, this getting the same idea across that David Lane puts out and that Bobby Jindal put out in his invitation letters, the idea that this country is really about Christians, and if you're talking about the future of America, you're really just talking about the right kind of Christians that they see having a hand in that.
Right.
And, you know, this was after a week in which he had been saying some pretty serious things denigrating Muslims. And right. So it's not just using the power of his office to proselytize for his faith, right. but to denigrate the faith of other Americans.
Exactly. The response, that was the name of this event, the response, nobody in Louisiana needed that. They know who Jindal is. They know what he claims. To whom was the response addressed?
Well, I think it was clearly addressed to, you know, the network of conservative evangelical preachers first, because that's who David Lane is trying to reach. Mm-hmm. His vision of building the kind of Christian America he wants is to turn conservative evangelical churches into political machines and voter turnout things. And yeah. so this was to promote Bobby Jindal to that group of people, to David Lane's constituency, and to put him on the map for people who are starting to look around about 2016. I mean, Jindal's got some competition, not just from the Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney's of the world, but for the evangelical crowd.
Right.
He's got Mike Huckabee and Rick Santorum, people who really have their own feet firmly planted in the religious right. One of the things I remember being struck by in the first few minutes of the rally, the MC coming out and again, you know, saying this is non-political and we're not here to lift up the name of any politician. And over his head on this huge video screen was a quote from Bobby Jindal about religious liberty and building America. So, yes, we're not lifting up any politician, any name but Jesus. But while we're doing that, we're lifting up the name of Bobby Jindal.
Yeah. In the big picture of American politics, this could be dismissed as a fringe element if it weren't for the fact that there are a lot of people who take this theocratic philosophy very seriously, seriously mm-hmm. enough possibly to attract some very big money donors. Do you think it is a legitimate concern for you and me to sit here and worry about the relationship between that theology and dominionism, which is anti-democratic?
Yes, and I would say not because I don't think he's going to come in with the notion of persecuting religious minorities or anything mm-hmm. like that. But I think it's still damaging in our public discourse because the whole message coming from these folks is American equals Christian. Mm-hmm. America was founded for Christians. That's who it's all about. That's who the future is going to be about if we have anything to say about it. And I think that is a toxic message in our public mm-hmm. discourse for religious minorities, for the growing percentage of our population that doesn't have any religious affiliation at all. And so I think that we should be concerned when we have high-level politicians using that rhetoric, standing on stage with and giving credibility to dominionists, anti-gay extremists, all these folks who are very eager to divide and exclude people from, you know, who's an American and who's an American that matters.
Yeah. I don't know these guys, the Koch brothers. I know that they certainly do want to run the nation. Are the Koch brothers people that appreciate this manipulation of religion for political gain?
I don't know them personally, but I would say politically, yes, I would think they do, because the Koch brothers occasionally put out there that, you know, they're really kind of libertarian on social issues. They don't care that much about gay marriage. But if you look at the political leaders who they're funding and backing, they're funding, you know, the farthest right folks they can get.
Right.
After Barack Obama was elected, there were a whole bunch of new coalitions formed on the right to fight him. And one of the most interesting ones is called the Freedom Federation, that created out of Liberty University and the Liberty Council. And it's a whole coalition of every religious right group you can think of, both the sort of mainstream religious right and the dominionist right, plus Americans for Prosperity. Now, what is Americans for Prosperity doing there? They were at the conference trying to convince people that they should view small government, anti-tax, anti-regulation with the same religious fervor that they have viewed gay rights and abortion rights. And so they – people like David Martin are out there saying – progressive taxation is unbiblical. Mm-hmm. Minimum wage is unbiblical. So I do think that the Koch brothers and Americans for Prosperity are very eager to merge the organizing energies of the religious right with their corporate anti-government, anti-regulation agenda.
And Jindal wants to be the drum major.
He sure does.
Peter Montgomery is a senior fellow at People for the American Way and an associate editor at Religion Dispatches. Peter, as always, I thank you for coming here today and talking with us and being on State of Belief Radio. And the other thing I appreciate is that we have every confidence that if this thing goes like we think it will, you're going to talk about it, and we're going to talk about it, and we're going to try to see that everybody that listens to us or will listen to us is going to hear about it.
That's right.
Last weekend was full of extremist right-wing activity. In addition to the response in Baton Rouge, we saw the Iowa Freedom Summit bring together pastors and politicians. You could only tell them apart by the name tags. A march against reproductive rights took place in Washington, and an initiative to elect 1,000 pastors to political office gained the endorsement of prominent politicians. Writing prolifically about all of this has been investigative journalist Sarah Posner. I'm very happy to welcome Sarah Posner back to State of Belief Radio. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Welton. Thank you.
There was some truly extremist rhetoric coming out of that Iowa Freedom Summit. Sarah, how much of that is going to be significant in the long term? And if you can, tell me we're not going to have to listen to that for 2 years.
Oh, we're going to have to listen to that until the Republican primary is finished and there is a nominee who will then track back to the center. But it's already clear that with Mike Huckabee, especially in the race, I think he is the one who's really going to push the rhetoric, at least on issues like culture war issues and religion issues, far to the right, maybe even more than Rick Santorum has been.
Did anything in particular stand out for you in the Iowa antics and rhetoric?
For one thing, I think that the people who do that bad lip reading show where they splice in lip reading of politicians and whatnot, they don't need to do it for Sarah Palin because she already just spouted some ridiculous, incomprehensible speech at the Iowa Freedom Summit. So that's already done. The thing that really stood out to me, though, it was Mike Huckabee talking about the Supreme Court. And he's basically saying the Supreme Court does not have the authority to decide whether bans on same-sex marriage violate the constitutional rights of gay and lesbian citizens. He thinks that this should not be a matter that's decided with any finality or certainty by the Supreme Court. Now, he claims to love the Constitution. So if he does love the Constitution, he should know that he is completely incorrect about this. The same notion that the Supreme Court cannot decide whether laws are unconstitutional or not was playing out yesterday in Alabama, where our good friend Roy Moore wrote a letter to the governor saying that as Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, he didn't think that anything federal courts had to say on the Alabama same-sex marriage ban would be binding on him.
Goodness. Sarah, was there anything that surprised you given the context of that event in Iowa?
Not really. I think that, you know, Steve King, who hosted or sponsored it, is well known for his extremist views, not just on religious issues or issues relating to abortion, gay rights, separation of church and state, and so on. So the fact that he was sponsoring it and that the candidates were trying to hew to his audience, that was very telling. And I think it was very telling about what the candidates are willing to do to win in Iowa. King is, even by the standards of the Republican Party, I mean, he's probably one of the furthest right and furthest out there rhetorically of any members of Congress. I mean, I think he's in the company of maybe Louis Gohmert and a couple of others. And so the fact that he's the one who's kind of the kingmaker and the one creating the environment where the candidates will try to out-conservative each other is really just telling about where they're willing to go and who they're willing to be their representative on reaching out to the base. Not all of the candidates or potential candidates went. Mitt Romney wasn't there. Jeb Bush wasn't there. But you see where this is playing out with the other candidates. They're all trying to run to each other's right.
Yeah, I actually thought it was funny. Jindal wasn't there because he couldn't get there because he was involved in his evangelistic campaign.
Yes, and Jindal couldn't go because he already had lined up his response. And, you know, Perry had already done that. Perry did that in 2011 and a couple days later announced his presidential candidacy. But I think that Jindal wasn't as good at it as Perry was, to be honest.
Right. Sarah, some analysts implied that Iowa was a bit of a sideshow, that the real action was occurring at the Koch brothers' summit in California because their 2016 campaign budget's almost double what the GOP spent in the past presidential election. So do you think there's a chance of new faces emerging in the race for the White House with less religious right and more Tea Party economic focus in their platforms?
Well, I think that somebody like Scott Walker or Marco Rubio might fit the bill there. Somebody who can cross over into both worlds, which both of those candidates can do. I mean, I think that in the Republican Party, the reason why you see Romney and Bush stepping out there and trying to outdo each other with their early entry into the primary is because there is a sense within the Republican Party that they need a sort of quote unquote mainstream business oriented candidate to run for them, that they cannot put somebody into the general election who's seen as a right wing religious panderer to the religious right. You know, and this is exactly what happened in 2008. It's what happened in 2012. All these candidates were in. They provoked all this discussion during the primaries, especially in Iowa, South Carolina, and Florida about religion and religious issues and LGBT rights and abortion and so forth. And then ultimately, they all competed with each other. And then in 2008, it was John McCain who emerged victorious out of that field. And in 2012, it was Mitt Romney who emerged out of that field. Now, that's not to say that they didn't try to pander to that same audience. They did, but just not in the same way that a Mike Huckabee or a Rick Perry, if she ran, a Sarah Palin would. I think the Republicans and maybe the Koch brothers are looking for somebody who can be so locked in before all of that sideshow even starts that the money will be in that person's corner and nobody else could even conceivably compete with it. But I don't think that's going to hold any of these candidates back. I think that they're still going to want to campaign on principle because they don't want to be shoved aside because the people with the money decided that Jeb Bush or Mitt Romney was the person they wanted to back.
Sarah, has God endorsed anybody yet?
You know, I think there are a lot of people who probably think he has, namely certain candidates, but I don't think so.
Sarah, we're staying with religion and politics, but changing the subject just a little bit. We saw an energetic march for life in Washington last weekend, followed by some unexpected results with anti-abortion legislation on the House floor. Would you talk about whether or not that movement is gaining ground across the nation as advocates insist, or are they wrong?
I think that public opinion polling on abortion has been pretty static over the past several years. So the idea that they're gaining ground in terms of public opinion, I think they're just blowing smoke on that. On the other hand, they have succeeded in many, many states in restricting access to abortion. If you look at Texas as an example, there's just very few facilities remain where a woman can get a safe abortion. So they've been very successful on that front, despite the fact that they really haven't gained ground in public opinion. Now, I think this controversy that played out the night before the March for Life, where congressional leaders decided to shelve this pain-capable Unborn Child Protection Act, is indicative of the nervousness of many Republicans who are worried that their party has just gone too far on this issue. And I think that that signals that they know where their constituents are on this. And these are representatives, you know, from red states, from North Carolina, from Indiana. And they realize that some of this is too extreme for their constituents. And so I think you're going to see a battle within the Republican Party over this. And I think it's going to be very interesting for voters because I think they're going to realize that the GOP is a little nervous about what it's portrayed as its lock on this issue.
So, Sarah, tell me what you think about 1,000 pastors running for public office. Who are the folks behind that?
Okay, so David Lane, he is a fellow who founded this organization called the American Renewal Project. And it is known for hosting these pastors' policy briefings, particularly around election time or primary time. They've done it in the States a little bit, but they're most known for it around the Republican presidential primary, where they bring in people like David Barton or Don Wildman of the American Family Association, which has a close relationship with the American Renewal Project. And they basically give lectures to pastors about why it's okay for them to be involved in politics and endorse candidates and why God wants them to be involved in politics and how America is a Christian nation. Lane's latest project is to recruit 1,000 pastors to run for office. And he had a training session for them in Baton Rouge the day before Bobby Jindal's prayer rally. And I think that this is a little bit of a mimic of the, you know, 1980s, 1990s Christian Coalition, recruiting people to run for state local office first rather than shooting for the stars from the outset. But the idea of specifically recruiting pastors for it is a little bit new.
Sarah, do they reason that what they're asking to be done and the reasons why they're asking that it be done really is a critique of secular democracy? Have they just given up on that?
They don't believe that that's what America is. They believe that America was founded as a Christian nation, that it has been perverted by secularism and feminism and LGBT rights. And, you know, the list probably goes on. And so they believe that what they're doing is restoring America to its Christian heritage. And that's why they think they need pastors to run for office, because, of course, you could trust pastors to actually run the country as a Christian nation, to govern from a biblical standpoint, what they think is a biblical standpoint.
Sarah Posner is an investigative journalist of the First Order who writes widely about religion and politics for The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Atlantic, The American Prospect, The Nation, Salon, and Religion Dispatches. Sarah's the author of the book God's Prophets, P-R-O-F-I-T-S, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Sarah, as always, I thank you for taking time to be with us at State of Belief, and I encourage you to keep up the analysis and the good writing you're doing.
Thank you so much, Welton.
Auschwitz. That one word, perhaps more than any other, has come to evoke the collective horror of the Nazi death machine that so effectively perpetuated the Holocaust. With the 70th anniversary of the Allied liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau just days ago, I want to look at how we're to continue ensuring never again, even as the last survivors reach their last years. And just as importantly, how we renew and make us relevant as possible the lessons of history for future generations. So I'm very pleased to welcome Shana Penn, Executive Director of the Tobey Foundation for Jewish Life and Culture, to State of Belief Radio. Shana, welcome.
Thank you so much, Wilson. I'm delighted to be here.
I'd like for you, please, to start by talking about the events around the observance of the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz.
So to say something about the events surrounding the 70th anniversary, this is a very big anniversary year, I think. The organizers of the event, which is the Polish government and the State Museum of Auschwitz, and the many international Jewish organizations and human rights organizations that helped to organize and bring people in to attend the ceremonies, are all very aware that this may very well be the last time that survivors of Auschwitz-Birkenau, the Jewish survivors, the Polish political prisoners, Roma, Sinti, Gypsies, Jehovah's Witnesses, Soviet political prisoners, etc. This may be the last time that they would be able to attend a ceremony such as this.
Mm-hmm. In your estimation, what was the most important parts of the remembrance?
Well, the remembrance this year, it really honored the victims of Auschwitz-Birkenau in a way that was not done at previous major anniversary events. It was fortunate that we could watch this around the world. It was streamed live, thanks to Google.
Mm-hmm.
And what you saw was, after the Polish president spoke, the next speakers were Holocaust survivors and then a Polish political prisoner. A lot of people don't know that the most people killed at Auschwitz-Birkenau were Jewish, 92% of those killed. And the second largest number of people killed were Polish political prisoners. In fact, the Auschwitz site originally was established by the Nazis to take in and incarcerate Polish political prisoners beginning in 1940. It turned into a death camp for Jews 2 years later in March 1942. So recognizing as many of the various victim groups who were at Auschwitz-Birkenau is very important, and this was done really appropriately this year.
Shana, was there an especially compelling moment that touched you that you could share with us?
One compelling moment for me was when Roman Kent spoke. Roman Kent, the Polish Jew from the city of Łódź, that had the second largest Jewish community up to World War II, and had the longest running ghetto. Roman Kent dedicated his life to Holocaust remembrance. He is one of the chairs of the International Claims Conference that today helps to determine ways to preserve Holocaust sites throughout Europe and the former Soviet Union, and to provide international funding for those preservation projects. He's a VIP, but he spoke as a survivor at the event, and he had tears in his eyes, which brought tears to everyone else's eyes, as he said, "My father told me when we were in Auschwitz together, he said to me in three languages, 'Remember, you must remember, Zachor,' that's how you say it in Hebrew, 'Pamiętaj,' that's how you say it in Polish. And that's what we are here to do. We are here to remember, and we are also here to defend democracy and human rights against any kind of intolerance and prejudice and racism that is happening in the world today." So he, as a survivor, was compelling because he linked his own past and the Holocaust past to the needs of the present day.
Hmm. Shana, you were at the 50th anniversary commemoration in 1995.
Yes.
But so much has changed in the world since then, and I'd like you to just reflect on the contrast between then and now, and are there any lessons to be learned in those contrasts?
One big difference is 1995 was only 6 years after the Cold War. So we were all very much in a post-Cold War era. And there were new democracies being formed in Eastern Europe, including in Poland, which at the time was headed by President Lech Wałęsa. And if you remember, Wałęsa won the Nobel Peace Prize for his leadership over the Solidarity Revolution in Poland back in August 1980. So he was considered a democracy champion. But he had a very difficult time as president of a new nation that had not yet wrestled with its Holocaust history in the way that West European countries had. Poland was no different from other East European countries coming out of communism that only had had about 6 years to start to grapple with what their complex and multiple roles were during World War II and in the Holocaust. And as a result, he performed actually a very disappointing, to say the least, and rather disgraceful role as the political leader presiding over this ceremony. He did not recognize the primacy of Holocaust memory, of Jewish memory at the site, until the international human rights community protested. And he did not allow the Jewish mourning prayer, the Kaddish, to be recited at the official ceremony. So his fellow Nobel Peace Prize recipient, Elie Wiesel, led a separate ceremony at Birkenau, which was the second large camp at Auschwitz, and this was where the gypsies were sent to be murdered in the gas chambers and then burned in the crematoria. So Wiesel held a separate alternative ceremony. And he also expressed his disappointment. And he said, for the world to hear, while not all victims of Auschwitz-Birkenau were Jews, all Jews were victims.
Hmm. Gosh, what a powerful thing.
And then he met with Walesa and helped Walesa to take a more appropriate position at mm-hmm. the remainder of the ceremonies. So under communism, the Polish Communist Party denied and repressed Holocaust memory and on all European memory at Auschwitz. They only focused on Polish memory, Poland, the national martyr that suffered the most in the Holocaust. Well, it's true that at Auschwitz, where there were 75,000 Polish political prisoners were killed, it was the largest number of Poles killed in one place anywhere during mm-hmm. the war. Mm-hmm. So it is an important site of Polish suffering, but it's a site that has to be shared among all the victim groups. Under communism, that wasn't done. And by 1995, Poland was still thawing from having been frozen, its memory frozen under communism, mm-hmm. and the Cold War was cold, and it took maybe a decade for the country to start to reckon with its Holocaust past. So this was not a positive moment in recent mm-hmm. Polish history, this commemoration. And so you see a big change just for Poland alone in terms of its political development and maturity over the last 20 years. Now it's in the EU. Not only is it a member of the EU, but its former Prime Minister Donald Tusk is now President of the European Commission. In terms of the global reality, we are in a very different time frame than we were back in 1995. 1995, we were still celebrating the end of the Cold War, the extension of democracy across new geopolitical borders, a pan-European identity. Countries were reaching out to one another. Democratization and human rights were the buzzwords of the time. And since then, we have been facing genocide, ethnic conflict, and terrorism, and that has come to dominate the frightening and devastating and negative events in our world today. Mm-hmm. In 1995, we might have thought we were finished with having such tragedies. Now we're realizing that these tragedies have taken new formations. And as such, one of the things that was also moving at this ceremony this week was that people were referencing the recent terrorism attacks in France and mm-hmm. in other places in Europe and making associations with Holocaust memory, not in an exploitative way, but to say what it really, one of its key values today, which is that it serves as a moral compass in a post-Cold War era. Mm. It's a moral touchstone in our contemporary world search for unity and shared values to address wars and ethnic conflicts and terrorism and instability and all the uncertainties that we're dealing with mm-hmm. right now.
In recent years, words like Nazi and Holocaust have been used again and again in completely inappropriate and irresponsible ways to try to score political points in the United States particularly. At the same time, we see a movement in parts of Europe to marginalize and demonize vulnerable groups, including but not limited to Jewish people. How can we combat these words losing their historical power while at the same time recognizing that we're never fully safe from the ugliest impulses of humankind?
I'm going to quote Professor Jonathan Weber, a British historian who is also a member of the International Auschwitz State Council, because in a recent conversation with him, I learned how much they are grappling with these very questions. And the keys are education and remembrance. At Auschwitz-Birkenau, for example, do you know that most of the visitors who come there today are not Jewish? They are non-Jewish Europeans or people from Asian countries who have no direct link to the Holocaust. And yet they are coming to learn about and to make meaning of these very words, Nazism, fascism, Holocaust. And what's happening at Auschwitz is that the tours, not only teaching about the very actual history that happened, but also helping people to make applications to contemporary realities. That is something, there must be a, you know, a massive public education campaign to continue to preserve and protect and respect the meanings of these terms.
What is most needed to connect as memory and wisdom what happened in the Holocaust and what is happening in our world today?
What we need is to continue to humanize and to personalize our realities. Mm-hmm. You know, we live in a global context today, and what's great about that is that we have access to one another around the world, but we don't necessarily touch each other. Mm-hmm. You know, we're less interactive because we're doing everything through the internet. Mm-hmm. Our hearts need to be involved now in a way that we may be losing touch, and also because we're bombarded with information. Mm. I think we need to be speaking to each other more.
Shana Penn is Executive Director of the Tobey Foundation for Jewish Life and Culture, instrumental in many important international projects. She developed and directs the Tobey Foundation's Jewish Heritage Initiative, and she's a scholar in residence at the Graduate Theological Union Center for Jewish Studies in Berkeley. Ms. Penn, I can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing with us. To listen to you and to know the content and subject matter of which you speak makes me feel a little bit like Moses hearing something that made him want to take off his shoes and say, "This is holy ground."
Thank you so much for inviting me to speak. I really appreciate the occasion.
Before we go, I should know better, but hearing all of the rhetoric from the religious right that we've highlighted on this week's show, and that was impossible to avoid this past week in particular, leaves me worried, saddened, and deeply offended. I've said it so many times before. Religious faith is something that is deeply personal, profoundly important, and far from two-dimensional for many, many Americans. The fact that I don't support Tony Perkins or Franklin Graham's or Rick Santorum's or Mike Huckabee's or Bobby Jindal's vision of an America based on their idea of biblical principles does not make me any less Christian or religious, and it doesn't make me less patriotic. Let me focus again on Jindal just for a moment, because I live under his supposed reign. I wish all of these people, Jindal in particular, could understand that there is a way to express an appreciation and a commitment to religion profoundly without getting in public ceremonies where they pound their chests and pray aloud. To be sure, everybody knows they're praying aloud. Let me take Jindal for example. But you could show religion and your appreciation for Christianity far more if Bobby Jindal would take Medicaid and actually increase health provisions for the people who don't have health insurance in Louisiana. Or, rather than standing up and praying before everyone, he could go before the legislature and make an impassioned plea for money for education in institutions of higher learning whose budgets he has cut by almost a third during his administration. I go back and think of the Hebrew Scriptures again. There is a question there that we would all do well, me and Bobby Jindal and all of these others as well, to think about. One of the prophets asked the question, "What does God expect of me?" The answer was, do justice, love mercy, walk humbly. You know, that's worth pondering. Look, I'm ready. In fact, I'm even eager to ensure that all of those gentlemen and any others are free to interpret their religion as they wish. And I believe that they, as well as people of faith and people of no faith, are equally entitled to live out their convictions as long as they don't encroach on anyone else's. That's not what we heard this past week. We heard about taking back America and about how no political candidate can solve our problems. What does that statement mean? Look, it's nothing less than a wholesale surrender of the democratic ideals that have made this a great nation for generations. It's nothing less than a betrayal of the pluralistic values that have ensured our freedoms for centuries. It is nothing less than treason. And whether such a call comes from a Democrat or a Republican, a Christian or a Muslim, a pastor or a politician, I intend to continue bringing attention to it and to sincerely opposing it for as long as it is necessary to do so. And I sincerely hope that you will join me. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. I want to thank you if you've made a donation this week. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/stateofbelief and share the stories you find compelling with your friends. We're also at twitter.com/stateofbelief. This isn't a time that we can take anything for granted. If you find value in what you hear on State of Belief Radio, then please spread the word. Help us out. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was. Yes, he was.